Welcome everybody to this, our first event of 2022. This is the Ventura County chapter of the Aerospace and Defense Forum.
You want to turn your video on, Gerardo?
You want to turn my, you want to see me too?
Sure. Why not? There you go.
Okay. To remember what I look like. Excellent. So today's presentation, we have one of the world's, if not the world's leading aviation expert, Richard Abolafia, who is going to be telling us about what is going to, what's the state of the aviation industry after what's probably been two of the most tumultuous years in aviation history. And it's not an easy thing to say, but it's probably true that since records have been kept on this industry for, 100 years, the last few years have been the most dramatic. And at the same time, have held a lot of promise for certain sectors of the industry. So before we talk into, before we go into Richard, let me just spend a couple of minutes telling you about the Aerospace Forum, and then we'll go into the presentation. So Ivan, if you want to go to the next slide. And the next slide. Thank you. So who we are, the Aerospace and Defense Forum is really a global community of aerospace and defense professionals. There's probably now more than 2,500. It really is an opportunity to connect with like-minded people in the industry and exchange views and generally just connect with other people in the industry. We now have 9 chapters, including Ventura County. And even during the pandemic, we kept doing meetings like this one, and we're looking forward to more in real life or in-person meetings later in the year. Next slide, please. Something about the Ventura County. Ventura, like most of the Southern California, is home to several aerospace companies. And the chapter is established to bring these companies together. So far, we've had a few events already. You can see them on the list. And the steering committee, you can see them on the slides as well. The chapter is growing. If you are interested in joining the chapter and help us grow, please get in touch. And we'll be having some very cool speakers for the remainder of the year. Okay, next slide. Next events. Again, after this presentation, if you're interested to listen to the next one, what's next in what's next for Big Aerospace on the, was it March 16? And then if you're interested in selling your business, the next one, Value Drivers for Your Business in May, will be worth attending, and that's on April the 20th. Okay. Next slide, please. Again, you know, join us, you know, you can join any chapter, for free, and you get a monthly newsletter, so you know what's going on in the industry. And you can also join individually. It's free for anybody who is outside any one of the 9, operating chapters. If you're in one area, ideally there's a fee, and that allows you access to everything above, plus all the presentations and all the videos that are being recorded. There's also a corporate membership, and if you want to sponsor events, always happy to do that. You'll get a chance to speak to the group at the beginning of the presentation, and of course you have all the other benefits before. So, you know, like, subscribe, and comment. So, next slide. Okay, we're almost there. Just housekeeping. Please need to move your microphone. You can stop your video and if you want to see us. Ideally set gallery view so you have the best view, and we'd love to hear from you on the chat. All questions will be taken from the chat. So without further ado, further delay, I want to clear Richard for takeoff. I think you the only introduction you need is if you really want to know what's going on in aviation today, Richard is the man to listen to. So without Richard, are you ready?
Yes, I am. As soon as I've unmuted and started my video. Thanks very much, Gerardo. Just you'd think after a couple of years of doing these video meetings, we'd figure out the whole, oh, right, that's how you unmute and that's how you start video. Anyway, it's my pleasure to visit with the good people of Southern California and the Ventura chapter of the Aerospace and Defense Forum. You're right. It's been a century. It's been a good century, but we never anticipated this. It's been an interesting 2 years. The only thing I can say is that I feel believe it or not, more confident than I have at any other previous point in these 2 years. I guess I'm here with some vague attempt at cautious good news, if you will. If I could get the next slide up, please. Thank you. You know, looking back 2 years ago, my colleagues and I sat down, my previous firm, Teal Group, I'm now with Aerodynamic Advisory, we tried to take a stab at what would be happening as a consequence of this pandemic. And we sort of put things into five buckets. And it's sort of a fascinating learning experience and kind of real-time forecasting, I guess. Talked to an awful lot of people and got a lot of interesting perspectives. The funniest anecdote I have from those rather difficult first days, I think it was April, and I was trying to figure out what was going on, so I called the oldest guy I knew who was in the business, Kai Von Rumer, an amazing veteran of Wall Street and equities industry equities analyst for many years, and his comment was, "Well, I thought I had lived long enough to see everything, but apparently I had not." So it's sort of been a learning experience, like I said. Now, look at this chart. We thought Twin Isle Jets would get hit hardest, first, longest, and we nailed that. It's been awful. Twin Isle Jets have just been clobbered. Now, we thought Single Isle Jets would get hit almost just as bad for a variety of reasons. And we got that wrong. I mean, it was bad, of course, in 2020, but boy, the market for single aisle jets has come roaring back. The most common thing that we talk about in, among the chattering classes to look at the industry and try to figure out what's going to happen next, the most common problem that people report is supply constraints, not demand ones. In other words, castings, forgings, people, all of the limits we'd see to meeting the production ramp. So, boy, did we get the single aisle jet thing wrong. Apologies. Business jets, equally wrong. I thought they would get hit pretty hard, but not that hard. I mean, somewhere in the middle, we sort of hedged it. We thought it would be a bad year. It was. We thought there'd be a couple bad years after that, and there have not been. Right now, things are really picking up. In terms of used jet availability, it's very low. In terms of pricing, it's getting a lot better. In terms of utilization, it's really excellent. So I'll give myself 30% right, 70% wrong, something like that. Civil rotary, the helicopter business, we thought would get hit lightly. And yeah, we were right. Actually, we were right about this. I'll give myself a check mark for this. And then military programs, we nailed it. We thought they would be just fine. If anything, there'd be an upside. And there has been an upside, largely for geopolitical reasons. We're living in strange and terrifying times. So defense markets have been doing just great. So how would I grade myself with this scorecard? Me and my colleagues, I'll blame them a little bit too. I'd say we absolutely nailed two of these. One we got terribly wrong, single aisle jets, business jets moderately wrong, and civil rotary kind of right. So I guess I'm giving myself a C minus looking back in the with the fullness of time here. Next page, please. Now you can see some of these numbers on the global output chart that we use to look at deliveries. 2020 and 2021 were simply terrible years. You can see that on the rightmost column. Nothing but red ink. Unpleasant, pure and simple. The only thing I can tell you is that some of these markets, or some of these segments, were not, fundamentally weak. You look at the military side of things, things really didn't fall from a market demand perspective at all. What happened was you had the usual logistical, problems associated, well, I shouldn't say usual, but you had logistical issues that were a consequence of the pandemic. So everything from supply chain disruptions to factory closures to people unable to take delivery of their jet because they couldn't travel. All sorts of things conspired to suppress the military market, but it wasn't organic to the market. However, on the other end of the spectrum, you look at single aisle jets and twin aisle jets there at the top. those were hammered pretty organically. Single aisle jets coming back, twin aisles, not so much. In aggregate, the industry fell by, 28% over the last couple of years. That's pretty much what I would have expected. You'll see rates of recovery towards the end of my presentation. Has it been pleasant? Oh, heck no. Next page, please. Now, looking at jetliners, going back to the dawn of the jet age, 1958, you can always see the practically biblically ordained cycle that the industry has been faced with. And we were on this remarkable tear between 2004 and 2018, a super cycle that lasted 14 years. And it would have kept going if it weren't for the MAX shutdown, which resulted in that little hook downward you see on the right side. And then, of course, you had the catastrophic drop associated with the pandemic in 2020 and a slight, ever so modest recovery in 2021. So time to party like it's 2006. Basically, the pandemic knocked industry output down to 2006 levels. This is, of course, the epicenter of the industry's pain. There's really... getting back to Gerardo's theme for the start of this presentation, it's 100 years you won't see anything like this. Next page, please. Now, we like to look at three drivers behind the jetliner business. And the first, of course, is traffic, passenger traffic. And what we've done is sort of come up with various expectations for market recovery. We've been doing this since it began. And it hasn't deviated that much. You sort of look at, first of all, I should just mention that in terms of a traffic drop, we've never seen anything like this again in 100 years. You look at traffic declines in the aftermath of the Great Recession, of Gulf War I, 9/11, all terrible events that at the end of the year, you saw a traffic drop of 3%. Well, at the end of 2020, the traffic drop was 66%. Nothing like that ever. So what does it look like getting back? We've seen the arrival of unpleasant new Greek letters that had not previously been in our alphabet, Delta, Omicron, and hopefully that's it, but who knows. The important thing is that none of them have interrupted the trajectory of our comeback. We're on our way back. Domestic markets are somewhere in the zone of like 85% recovered. International, that's nowhere. That's somewhere, 45, 50%. And that, of course, is a question of all kinds of border closures and travel restrictions and everything like that. Where are we now? We're on path for a recovery to the 2019 travel peak sometime in the second half of 2023. That hasn't changed a whole heck of a lot. At one point, before I joined Aerodynamic, was feeling incredibly optimistic about vaccines, and I think I changed it to December 2022. I was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. We're back to where we were when we started. We see a recovery in the second half of 2023. Now, of course, there's still impairment because you don't make good, those lost years. We think that at the end of 2026, we're going to see an impairment of about 11% relative to where we would have been before COVID. So that's a little unpleasant, but at least we're on the path back. So in aggregate, the single most important driver behind the jetliner market recovery, traffic, we're on the way back. Next page, please. The second is a little more abstract, and it is the difference between the cost of capital and the cost of fuel. And why this matters? Well, you want a world in which fuel is kind of expensive, so airlines want new jets to replace their older, thirstier stuff. And cost of capital, they want to be able to finance these new jets with cheap money. And this is really good news. The second driver is in great shape. Fuel, we don't know, of course, what the end of the year is going to look like, but right now it's north of 80. We think, the Energy Information Agency tells us that the year might, average out to high 70s. We'll see. There are, people in the fuel business who caution that it could be in the 100 range. I doubt it. I don't really know. No one's an expert in fuel prices, even the experts on fuel prices. But in general, it's not in a bad zone. I mean, you want fuel to be around, say, 50 to 85 a barrel, just so people want new jetliners. There at the bottom, you can see the cost of capital. It hasn't budged a whole heck of a lot. Obviously, the Fed has announced that it will be raising interest rates. It doesn't look like that'll be ruinous by an historic standard. You know, I mean, you could get to 2-3% wholesale and the industry is still fine, even 4% still fine. I'm sure there are some inflation hawks out there who think that, you know, it's going to be terrible inflation. You're going to need interest rates to be 10%. I don't think most people see that coming. So in aggregate, this difference, this measure, the split between the cost of capital and the cost of fuel, it's in a great place. It really is. So that leaves the third most important driver behind jetliner demand. And this is not so happy. Next page, please. Whenever we have had a conversation about single aisle production rates for the past couple of decades, we've also been having a conversation about China. China has been the remarkable growth story behind this industry. And as you can see, they went from 2% of global jetliner deliveries 20 years ago to a peak of 23% in 2018. Now, bad news, China's aviation market slowdown actually predates the pandemic. They're coming back because they were hit just as bad as anybody by the pandemic, but are they coming back to where they used to be or coming back to where they were in 2019, which wasn't a good place? And it's not an economic thing, we don't think. Rather, it is a culture thing. The government simply said, you know, that whole market economy thing, the whole individual economic liberty thing, it's not working for us. Get your Mao jackets to the dry cleaners. We're reimposing a heavier-handed form of state socialism. That's really bad. And you were starting to see air travel demand numbers really take a hit. For example, in 2018, the end of the year, you had 12.2% year-over-year growth in revenue passenger kilometers. A year later, that was knocked down to 5.3. That's terrible. So we don't know, but frankly, it doesn't look good. I'm 99% sure that the MAX will be recertified in China sometime in the next 3 to 4 months. Does that matter as much as it used to? Probably not, because it's going to be a long time before they need the kind of jet intake that they could be counted upon for the past couple of decades. At their peak, they were taking 355 or so. If they get back to 250, I'd be thrilled. So the third indicator behind the jetliner market recovery, I'm afraid that one is not functioning as well as I'd like to say. Next page, please. On the positive side, you know, one key metric we follow is the book-to-bill ratio, which, of course, you all know. It's just the ratio of orders to deliveries. And last year, for the first time, another first-time ever metric, it wasn't even calculable because, of course, orders were net negative. This last year, 2021, not only were they measurable, but they were actually slightly above 1-to-1. That was fantastic. That's a nice recovery. So again, as I mentioned at the start, the single aisle jetliner market has shown remarkable resilience, largely because of the appeal of the new generation aircraft, the Neo and the Max, but also because domestic markets are making such a robust recovery in the air travel business. Next page, please. Now, what are we expecting? Well, you know, one thing our economist friends tell us is you see K-shaped patterns everywhere. You'll see a number of them in this presentation. That bifurcation between the cost of capital and the cost of fuel, that's a K, that weird collection of two lines going in two different directions, K-shape. And you're seeing a K-shaped recovery in the jetliner business. You know, the single aisles, there's your blue line at the top, roaring back. You know, by the fourth quarter of 2022, we will be at the peak, and then we're going to go way beyond the peak. Twin aisles, I don't know, asset values, utilization, all of the indicators, really not good. Lease rates, really not good. Just one of the problems is that there was a massive level of overbuilding and therefore an overhang of overcapacity courtesy of the last decade. Another problem is that these new single aisles are extremely capable particularly the 321neo. You know, they can do transatlantic. They can do a lot of Middle East Asia, Middle East Europe. And you're starting to see a major secular shift in airline fleet planning away from twin aisles and towards single aisles. So like I mentioned at the start, twin aisles are kind of the center of our industry's pain and are going to be for some time. Next page, please. Major issue with Boeing's backlog here, and we've measured that in two different ways. The ASC 606 accounting provisions are something that they use, to their credit, that adjusts for customer risk. Airbus doesn't have that. So we've looked at Boeing both ways, with or without ASC 606. And either way, Boeing's taking a hit here. You can see end of 2021. Next page, please. And it isn't at all hard to figure out what the problem is. It is that A321neo market. If you look at all the segments of the jetliner business, it's very clear that Boeing has a serious disadvantage in that single aisle 200 seat segment. And the 321neo orders that you can see on the right, well, that's just growing. I mean, everyone wants a new mid-market jet to take advantage of route fragmentation. And because they have rediscovered with the pandemic the time-honored maxim that all of us in the aviation business have known for years, which is that small is really beautiful. You know, or as Robert Crandall put it many years ago when he was at American Airlines, you never went bankrupt flying a plane that was too small. Go bankrupt flying a plane that's too big. Anyway, this is a major issue for Boeing. Next page, please. However, another major issue, Boeing continues to cut its engineering workforce, and you can see that in its independent research and development spending. Last year, it fell 20%. The year before, it fell 30%. This isn't good. And obviously, if they are going to do a new jet to respond to the 321neo, this has to be reversed. This is the biggest single question in aviation, indeed, in all of aerospace. Will Boeing do the right thing? And I can't guess it. I think we should give them another year. After that, I begin to have serious doubts. I already have serious doubts, but my doubts get a lot more serious. Next page, please. Now, assuming that Boeing doesn't do anything until after 2030, this is the result. Boeing is there in the dark blue, Airbus light blue. The wedge between them is the 321neo. And we're being conservative here with our 321neo orders. It could be that more 787 demand gets hollowed out and goes to the 321neo. But either way, Boeing is kind of being boxed in a corner. And what was 50-50 is going to become 60-40, maybe even 65-35. By the end of our forecast period here, 10 years hence. So this is, again, a major challenge for Boeing and the biggest single question mark in the industry. What will they do? Next page, please. Turning to the defense side of the house, you know, one big issue with this downturn relative to the last one, the 2002 downturn, is that defense spending is so much more robust. You can see that with the investment accounts. Research and development, that's the red line, that's at an all-time high, ever. Procurement, it's roughly three times as much as it was during the last downturn. And DOD has actually, and the broader U.S. government, during both administrations, has done a really great job of, leveraging this and providing accelerated payments to the supply chain and doing, you know, everything it could to make this cash flow faster when the industry was under siege. That's been a godsend. You know, people ask, why haven't there been more bankruptcies in the industry during this terrible downturn? I would argue that that accelerated payments program was one of the biggest single factors in avoiding carnage in our business. And, it'll hopefully the history books will reflect that. Anyway, great environment for defense. Next page, please. And globally, too. You know, it's pretty much every major defense market is on the up. Unfortunately, the fastest growth one, look at that red line in the middle, that's China, not an addressable market and indeed a threat market. The decline in China's civil aerospace demand has effectively been accompanied by the rise of China as a forcing function in higher defense spending, both in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world, particularly Australia, Japan, South Korea, but also the NATO countries. Interestingly, Russia's kind of nowhere here, like barely discernible to the eye. So they're good at threatening. They're really good, of course, at menacing their neighbors. Are they good at creating a large first-class military that can actually go much beyond their immediate territorial area and of course, the people directly next to them? No, not really. When we have a conversation about peer adversaries, we're really talking about China. Next page, please. Combat aircraft market, fantastic market. F-35 there at the bottom, then F-35 International, very strong, getting stronger. What's interesting about the F-35 is that last year, DOD and Lockheed Martin announced that levels of output would be capped at 156 per annum. That's lower than market demand. And they didn't really qualify it. The general thinking is they're waiting for the Block 4 upgrade to kick in so they don't have to modify as many planes. But you look at all the undetermined competition, that's that competition, that's that green slab above, and if just a third of those go over to the F-35, you could see very heavy upward pressure on F-35 output, and I would expect numbers to get to the 180 level if they can get Block 4 up and running, and of course if they can solve any supply chain challenges and whatever else. One of the big questions, next generation air dominance, NGAD. We know it's coming. We know it's flying in prototype form. That might not mean very much because a prototype can be, you know, it could be 10 years between a prototype flying and a production aircraft flying. But we know it's coming, and we know it's going to be essential because of that China challenge. We just don't know when it starts impacting the market. Our assumption is it's around the early 2030s, but we don't know. It's a program that's heavily in the black, so still quite secret and stealthy. Next page, please. Broader U.S. aircraft output. Great news. Look at that B-21 line at the top. That is California's triumphant return to aircraft production. Believe it or not, when the last C-17 was delivered, California, aside from Robinson Helicopters and whatever black programs they do out in Victorville and areas like that, California had exited for the first time since ever fixed-wing aircraft programs. But the B-21, I'm happy to say, gets California back in the game. Excellent. And of course, the broader roadmap is heavily dominated by F-35, but excuse me, we don't have anything else really dying. The F-18 might just die around 2027, but there's a lot of things, a lot that can happen between now and again. It's kind of funny looking back in my 30-something year history of watching this industry. I never would have guessed that the F-15 would outlive the FA-18, but that appears to be the likely outcome here. Next page, please. Europe under a lot more pressure for the simple reason that they don't have an F-35 or a B-21. A lot of legacy programs that are ramping down, not catastrophic, but you know the big question in Europe is how they can get their act together with their next-gen programs, Tempest and SCAF, and you know, whether or not they're in the current right alignment of partners and whether they can be funded on time. We expect that Tempest happens and then SCAF becomes a purely French program, but neither of them really show up in this chart until after this chart ends, basically sometime around 2037, 2038. It's going to take a while for them to ramp up those programs. Next page, please. Summing up before I turn back over to my hosts and take some questions in our time. So 2 years ago, I'm out there giving presentations and confidently expecting the future to look like that blue line there at the top. And you've got that MAC shutdown that's kind of forcing things. And I'm like, okay, that's unpleasant. That hurts, but we'll be fine. Look at that blue line. We're coming back. But instead, we fell into that. Well, that black line, that pit, that hurts. You know, life comes at you fast. All I can tell you is that, as the theme of my presentation goes, climbing out of a pit sure feels a hell of a lot better than falling into one. Feels better, and of course, it leads people to do different things in terms of hiring and machine tool purchases and facilitation, whatever else. So, you know, it'll be a better recovery than it was a collapse. That's all I can say. The military market hasn't changed that much. Maybe it's gotten a little stronger. Still pretty strong. Next page, please. You add up all of our, well, recovery paths, and what we've done here is index them. So 2019 in most cases, 2018 in a couple of cases, is the, you know, base peak. So look at the very top line. That's world GDP. The economy has done great. It's all come back. The dotted line is world revenue passenger kilometers per our aerodynamic forecast. We have that, as I mentioned, recovering in 2023. All the other sectors in our industry basically get back to peak in 22 or 23 and then on to new heights. One major exception, look there at the bottom, twin aisle jets. Again, that's the theme of my presentation. I'm afraid twin aisle jets is sort of the center of our pain and will be for some time to come. Everything else is coming roaring back. So it's been a learning experience the past couple of years. And I'm sure we've all felt that way. It's been a privilege speaking with you. I'm very happy to turn over now back to Gerardo for any questions you might have. Oh, sorry, I've got one last. Thanks for keeping me honest there, Gerardo. One last chart. The market is more concentrated than ever. You know, you look at the top, well, 20 programs in this business, and I'm privileged to follow about 150 programs. I shouldn't bother, really. I mean, I love them, but really, the top 20 programs drive 77% of industry output. And that, of course, is true. Most of the people in the audience today are suppliers. This is true for you, too. When you focus your business development efforts, please keep this in mind. The top five should be your biggest priority because they're 55%. And frankly, the 320 family is kind of casting shade on everything else. And then the next 15 or 22%. And after that, you get into the weeds. Not to say you shouldn't pay attention to them, but this is an industry based upon critical mass and high barriers to entry. And with that, I'm 99% sure. Right, Gerardo? I have that right? Last chart?
Yeah.
Thank you. There we go. There's my last chart. Someone put that picture for us. I really love it. And I'm happy to talk about anything you like. So back to you, Gerardo.
Thank you very much. It was great. As I said before, we're going to be taking questions in the chat. And just to get us started, I'm going to ask a few questions of my own that I found very interesting. I think one of them is, of course, related to the people in Ventura County. And you mentioned, you alluded to this, most of these are manufacturers that sell to integrators or to the majors. So what would you think are the characteristics of the recovery? What does that mean for mostly small and medium manufacturers like the ones in Ventura? What do you think that we should be paying attention? I mean, you just mentioned that in the last slide, but is there anything else you can add to that?
Yeah, you know, of course, the most important thing is what's your portfolio looking like? And if it's heavily military and it's heavily single aisle or heavily business jets, you know, you're golden. But having said that, there's this real challenge. My colleague Kevin Michaels, co-managing director at Aerodynamic, always makes the point that all the supply chain is obviously it's been weakened by this experience. In order to survive, they had to sell a lot of things. They had to take in a lot of debt. It's been deeply unpleasant. And as a consequence, finding the working capital needed to make the production ramp is going to be a big challenge. And if, heaven forbid, we have another downturn or a false start on the recovery road or whatever else, it's going to make it that much harder still. So I think the important thing is, you know, the supply chain is fragile. The market is coming back. The cash is going to be flowing. But they've done everything they could to survive. And you got to be mindful of that because it's, you know, it's a lot can go wrong, as we've seen for the past few years. I guess those are my key thoughts when I look at the supply chain. But, of course, I could you know, elaborate on any of that. Is that sort of what you had in mind there, Jordan?
Yes. Thank you. actually, I'm going to take one of the questions that's on the chat. You mentioned China as a very important market. What is your projected impact of China's development of its own single aisle aircraft?
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting, I've been following that for decades, and you'll see if you go to my website, which is free, richardovalafia.com, there's a lot of writing on it. I'm sort of become obsessed with the issue. It's sort of fascinating to me. A couple of columns in Foreign Policy magazine, you'll see that I authored over the past 2 years. The thing to remember is they're not really Chinese aircraft, quite frankly. I mean, they have a superficial veneer of Chinese content, skins and the integration, but all of the value add inside is Western, which puts them in a rather difficult position because we now have these military end user lists that were started by the Trump administration but continued by the Biden administration, and they're deliberately vague. Basically, there's a lot that suppliers can or can't sell to not COMAC, but its parents. It's all deliberately vague, and we don't know what or when or if sanctions like those are going to impact the development of those programs. Because it's been a long road for Chinese industry to develop its own branded aircraft, but my God, that road is as nothing compared to the road needed to develop engines, avionics, and every system on board. That adds another 20 years and tens and perhaps a lot, scores of tens of billions of dollars to the development bill. So there's this weird relationship with, you know, what the Chinese think they can do to maintain autarky, to basically go their own way, and what they can actually do. And this gets into the broader question of trade tensions between the U.S. and China. I think there's, you know, first of all, it's going to be a while, still a few years before they can do any kind of serious ramp. And when they do, if they choose to accompany that ramp with a decision to close the borders, to violate the WTO to Western jets, well, I think the U.S. and other Western powers can kill their national programs with the flip of a switch. Again, all the value add is imported. So it's a fascinating and rather difficult situation, I'm afraid. It's not what I expected after all these decades of China's development.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on, there's a couple of questions. I think this one that I'm actually going to ask with. You talk about kind of the 5-6 main market segments. And there's some talk that this reshuffling has kind of shifted some of the traffic from basically bigger twin aisle airplanes to smaller crafts. So one of the questions here is like, how do you see that market evolving? I think we've spoken this before about, you know, urban mobility, eVTOL, hydrogen power aircraft. And someone's asking about, you know, do new fuels or new kind of energy. Is that going to reshape the industry? And it's also kind of preferences of passengers. What you see that happening is there an opportunity to create another market segment perhaps for these other new type of aircraft with alternative energy sources?
Yeah, you know, fascinating. We could talk about this for hours, of course. Yeah. And one of the most interesting aspects of the past couple of years has been the proliferation of what you might call new aero, like new space. There's new aero too. I tend to think a lot of it is somewhat overblown, but hey, experimentation is always welcome. Hydrogen, let's deal with that because it's been sort of front and center. The people I've respected most over the years tell me it's just a complete non-starter. In particular, Dr. Alan Epstein over at MIT has been really out there saying, no, you don't understand, this is just dumb. And I respect Alan immensely. And a lot of other people have sort of his ilk have been saying that. And having said that, you know, there is money going into small hydrogen transports. Maybe it's a question of scaling. Maybe for small propeller planes, there's a point, you know, under 500 nautical miles or something, where some use of hydrogen fuel cells makes sense. But hydrogen as an alternative fuel for long-range jetliners, boy, I mean, you have to keep the stuff cooled to 257 degrees minus Celsius. You can't really use your wings for fuel anymore. They become useless chunks of metal. So many things go wrong with hydrogen in terms of aircraft design. So I tend to think Alan Epstein is quite probably right about this, except for smaller applications, and there the jury is out. So many other things to talk about. When it comes to advanced air mobility, urban air mobility, you know, I tend to think this is exciting, but these are helicopters. These are expensive. And I don't routinely travel in a helicopter because, oh, right, they're expensive. So I want to believe, but you have to ask yourself, how often do you get exclusive, personalized access to any machine that costs $4 million? It doesn't happen too often to me. And I think this kind of gets lost in the whole debate. But again, experimentation is welcome. The supersonic thing, one thing that shocked me was the death of Aireon back the previous year. I would have thought they would have had a chance, but they didn't. Boom is continuing. I see there in your placeholder. I'm intrigued by Boom. You know, I don't see it myself, but again, good to see experimentation. It seems to be the opposite of ESG and decarbonization. You know, I mean, going supersonic is never going to be green, no matter what you do. So I look at the world of what's coming next, and the only thing that I think really fills me with, you know, that has a good chance, is SAF. You know, sustainable aviation fuels, there's a lot of experimentation, a lot of interesting research, and I hope it continues because that appears to be the best way forward.
Okay, very good. Tim, we're getting close to the top of it, of our hour, so we have time for maybe a couple of questions. Let me see if we take the last one. What do you think, Ivan? Well, I'm going to read this one from Ivan. If Boeing does not develop a new SA, do they survive as a force in the industry? If so, how does the product mix change to perhaps to more military?
Oh, boy, that's a great one. And be afraid, right? I mean, given the cuts to their engineering workforce, and you know, you've got the broader engineer demographic problem here, where salaries are just galloping upward at all the tech companies, especially those in Boeing's backyard. And then you've got the draw of new space, and you've got the draw of urban air mobility, which, you know, I don't believe in hugely, but on the other hand, it is hiring a lot of people because it's well-funded. And then you've got the military side, again, that record R&D budget. The big question, how does Boeing hire back the engineers it needs to do a new single-aisle jet in the face of all of this inflationary pressure? That just gets harder and harder as the years go by. Do we take them seriously as a jet producer? Yeah, that'll take decades to go away. But if they don't do a new aircraft in the next couple of years, from the standpoint of a new production or new creation player, yeah, I think we just have to take them seriously. If they don't do it in the next few years, they're not going to have the capability to do it in 2030.
Which is a lot to say for a company like historically being like a pillar of the industry.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, one question I get asked from the military side looking at this is, wait, from a national security standpoint, isn't this an issue? And it's sort of funny, we've never really had industrial policy front and center in our government. You know, the Europeans do industrial policy. Most Asian countries do industrial policy. We don't. In other words, if Boeing chooses to exit commercial jets, which means, of course, that the U.S. chooses to exit commercial jets, it's not really clear there's a mechanism to stop them from doing that. Right. And that's a great concern.
Okay. Now we're quarter to the hour, so probably have time for one last question. And this is my question to you is, if you had $100 to invest in the aviation industry, what would your portfolio look like? What sectors or where would you put your money?
Well, you know, you're talking to the most conservative guy you're going to meet in the world of investment, right? So this is more of a personality thing rather than a, ooh, smart, I'm going to do that. So my money is in index funds for that reason, and I would put it in a really good index fund, which, of course, is one of the, you know, diverse suppliers that we've got out there in the world. Having said that, and I also tend to favor big caps because, of course, they tend to not, you know, be as vulnerable. You know, I tend to look, you know, I think Raytheon and Northrop Grumman are extremely well positioned. again, this is all just a function of me being extremely conservative and looking for something diverse and defensible. You can make an argument, and people have, that some of the people exposed to the single aisle jet ramp up, like say Spirit, for example, are really well placed. I believe in that. Again, this is me being conservative here, but I think there's a strong argument to say that. So I think anything that was exposed to that single aisle jetliner ramp up, wonderful. You can make an argument that the way business jets are coming back, boy, companies like General Dynamics or Textron pretty well exposed. But again, it's not without risk. And again, I'm kind of the most risk averse human you're going to meet.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for that. Let me ask, Ivan, how are you doing for time? I think, do we need to wrap up now? I think it's now to begin to wrap up. And
we've scheduled to go till 9 o'clock. So you've got another 10 minutes. Do you want to answer some more questions? I'm reluctant to let Richard go when we get him.
Let me see. There's a bunch of other questions now. And so let me see. There's another one on China. We talked over China. There's a question. What are your perspectives on the MRO market for one engines and airframes and components? So again, because a lot of manufacturing is in this part.
Obviously, it's coming back pretty fast. I guess here again, I'm concerned about bottlenecks in terms of workforce and whatever else. I have little to say other than, of course, it's closely linked with the ASK recovery, which looks pretty darn robust to us now, and the fact that there was so much, anything that could be deferred was deferred. I'm a little concerned from an MRO standpoint about the, ever-increasing time on wing of the new generation engines. I think this is an issue that concerns a lot of people in this business. You know, there's an awful lot of stuff that used to be sort of mandatory intervals and now is event-limited. And that definitely is going to impact things. But in terms of the broader industry comeback, it looks good to me.
Okay. kind of going back to Boeing, Gus asked, it appears that Boeing will be, will go for a new single aisle jet, like we were talking. With that comes a larger market share for Airbus on the twin aisle. So what would the strategy be for the 400, 737, 900, and the MAX that need to be delivered? So I guess if Boeing keeps exiting the twin aisle, someone else going to that part of the market, how are they going to be competing with Airbus?
Boeing is actually its greatest strength is in the twin aisles with 777X and 787. You know, the problem there, of course, they've got production difficulties. Those have been well publicized. You know, that's not pleasant, but the products themselves are really quite good. And I'd sort of reframe the question. The real issue is that because of this demand shift away from twin aisles, how does Boeing respond to that? Because it used to be that, when its core strength was twin aisles and twin aisles were half the market, so that's great. But what if twin aisles are only 30% of the market? And that's where it needs this big single. Now, I think I also heard in that question maybe an implication that doing a new big single would endanger the 737 MAX. I would disagree with that because, the 757 and 737 coexisted very happily for decades, and you'd be looking at a repeat of that, both kicked up a notch, a sort of a super 757 clean sheet, of course, playing that 210 to 230 seat role, and then 737 MAX 7, MAX 8, MAX 9 probably, and MAX 200, the high-density version of the MAX 8, they'd be doing just fine. Would the MAX 10 get clobbered? Yeah, realistically, it probably would. But, given the alternative of letting Airbus run away with that large single-aisle market, I think it's Boeing's wisest course.
Okay. Okay, I think we still have time for more questions. Keep putting your questions in the chat. I do have another question. Going to the military, and we saw the chart of how kind of concentrated the programs were. And if you think about the airplanes today, it's really the F-35 seems to be kind of what everybody's talking about. What are some of the benefits or risks of relying so much on kind of a single type of aircraft for the U.S., both in terms of or national security and also for manufacturers?
God, I love that question. And it's a huge one. And I think a lot of people in Washington and elsewhere are kind of realizing the limits. You know, first of all, it's a jack of all trades plane designed for the post-Cold War world, which means it's not a performance aircraft. It's got, you know, the joke that everyone told years ago was the F-22 was an amazing air vehicle in search of a good mission equipment package. And the F-35 is an amazing mission equipment package in search of a good air vehicle. You know, it's okay if you could combine the two. That's the war winner. And NGAD effectively is that. It is that combination of an amazing air vehicle and an amazing mission equipment package. And it's a response to the limits of the F-35. So the question becomes, when does NGAD get up and running? When does it impact, therefore, the market, the procurement budget for the F-35? And the answer is sometime around the end of our forecast period. Absolutely. Now, there are so many other aspects to this question that I find fascinating. One is, you know, when the enemy figures out how the platform behaves, that's useful. And, of course, given data theft and other IP leakage, that's an area of concern. And there are people who think that the F-35 in the Pacific is a little bit compromised because of what China has learned. That's a major concern. Another, of course, is range. It's a tactical fighter, you know. Even if it does get the new engines that have been proposed, it's still, you know, what, 650, 700 nautical mile range? So there is this school of thought that maybe there should be a much greater emphasis on platforms like the B-21, which really do have, obviously thousands of miles of range. Right. And then on top of that, and maybe this has sort of become the stock answer for everybody's problems in tactical aircraft, what about the rise of teaming, manned-unmanned teaming in the form of Skyborg or whatever program you want to call it, where we have these adjunct air vehicles operating in tandem with a mothership? And what does that mean in terms of F-35 demand? I expect that when that kind of teaming systems, those teaming systems come online, probably late 2030s, the F-35 loses a bit of relevance. So, you know, it's a fascinating question. I could go on and on about it, but boy, many factors.
Maybe next time. I think we have time for one more question. It says, if we continue on this subject, let's see, wouldn't a modified F-22 be a lower development cost for, I don't know what NGAD means. We need the range tens and new generation of hypersonic missiles bolted into it.
Well, that's a really super cool aspect of NGAD, next generation air dominance. We don't know what it is. Maybe it's that, right? I mean, it probably isn't, but you can't rule it out. For years, the idea of a mashup with F-22 with F-35 engines and mission systems has been sort of the killer app, the holy grail of the business. And at one point, there were serious discussions, I believe, with the Japanese about doing that for their next generation requirement. Whenever I bounce it off people, they say, it's kind of in the opposite of a sweet spot. You're spending an awful lot on non-recurring and not really advancing the state of the aeronautical art. Maybe that's subtext for, we want to do a really new, cool airplane and we're going to do it, damn it. And from what they've said about the NGAD prototype that's flying out there, it is new. It is indeed faster, more capable, higher altitude, time to climb. All of these metrics are better than we had with the F-22. Having said that, somewhere on my website from years ago, I think I wrote something saying exactly the same thing. We should look at an F-22 upgraded because I always thought it was cut short way too early. One other thing that unfortunately the Air Force has realized is that because of the computer architecture built into the F-22, this thing kind of expires sometime in the early to mid 2030s. It just becomes a major challenge from a computer architecture standpoint to upgrade, and that doesn't appear to be changeable. I don't know whether that's absolutely true, but the Air Force is certainly talking like that. So anyway, that's a great question. Thank you for that.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to begin to wrap up. So Richard, just before we dismiss, when we end, just we need to stay quiet for a couple of minutes just to make sure the recording works. And I think we're at the end of our presentation. Thank you very much, everybody. It's been a real pleasure. Richard, it's an honor and privilege just to speak to you. It's mind blowing. I'm glad we have this discussion at the early, you know, early in the year, because now we're going to see how the whole thing evolves and hopefully, you begin to get your score up. I think you can get I will give you at least an A minus as far as I'm concerned. Well, everybody else, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And, stay tuned for our next, events coming shortly. Thank you very much and have a good day.